it is kind of interesting because if you look around, maybe except for the really trophy buildings in Chicago, office buildings, they might have 30 or 40 year lifespans before they really start to lose in technology and, you know, location, and everything changes about them. Their values decrease a lot as an office use, and you have to start to contemplate, you know, what else can I do with this asset?
I'm pleased to introduce Scott Sarver to the Office Space Podcast. Scott is a principal at Ratio Architects and is based in Chicago. Ratio is an international design studio with disciplines in architecture, interior design, landscape architecture, urban design, preservation, and graphic design. Some of their projects include the NCAA headquarters in Indianapolis, the PNC Arena in Nashville, the Centropolis in Seoul, South Korea, which consists of two 26-story office towers, and the Lincoln Tomb in Springfield, Illinois. I did throw in that last one because it's just so random, but it does demonstrate the diversity of your firm. Throughout Scott's career, he's created dynamic urban projects for private developers in more than 40 countries and is a tremendous resource for our topic today, which is on the repositioning and adaptive reuse, specifically office to residential. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Dougal.
So we were discussing some of your projects, and you mentioned Cairo. Can you chat about that for a minute?
Sure. In Cairo, and as in many places, the government is consolidating its facilities that were in the center of the town into a new town that's 30 miles east of the city. And that has left a lot of these former office buildings and government uses available for reuse in a prime location. So I was just there a few weeks ago, and we're working with Oxford Capital here in Chicago to sort of reposition. It's called the Mogama El Tahrir, which is the main office building on Tahrir Square in central Cairo, into a luxury lifestyle hotel, very much modeled on the London House here in Chicago.
Very neat. When is that set to be completed?
At the end of 2024.
Yeah, that's assuming all the materials are on time and everything, right?
Yes, it's kind of daunting. It's a really massive building. It feels like about the same size as the Merchandise Mart, but it has a lot of light courts within it that alleviate the areas and make it good for a hotel use.
Fantastic. All right, so let's dig into our topic here. And once again, we're talking about office to residential. So what are the general differences between office buildings and residential buildings?
To begin with, office buildings generally, and I'll talk about maybe a little more modern office buildings, are generally planned at a density of about 5 people per 1,000 square feet, whereas residential uses typically might be, you know, 1.5, 2 people per 1,000 square feet. So much lower density of occupancy. So right off the bat, you know, in terms of facilities and services, you know, you should be less than an office building use. They typically have higher floor to floors because of the mechanical systems, and all of those things are good, but they also have deeper lease spans from the glass to the core wall, which typically is somewhat of a, might be 45 feet in a modern office building, and you might be looking for something more like 30 feet in a residential building. So technically, those are the kind of challenges, I'll say, but we can usually find a way to get around those. What I would say is, for me, tier one is the location, the address, the context, and the neighborhood, transportation, all of those aspects. If it is supportive of that conversion to a residential use in that location, if that all follows through, then we go into these more technical issues, and we can generally get through those because of all the floor heights, and everything is more than you would require for a residential building.
And what about from a hospitality standpoint?
Hospitality, it's a little different in that there's generally a podium of meeting rooms and restaurants and those sort of supportive functions that you might not find in an office building. But again, those can kind of be accommodated. I mean, you can look at the Langham as an example, and you know, Mies van der Rohe's IBM Tower, where a very high-end luxury hotel was accommodated within an office building, including a ballroom.
And that used to be a home for you at one point, right? As far as your office home?
Yes, it was. It was truly a wonderful building to be in.
Right. So when you get an assignment to look at a conversion, first of all, what are the steps you're taking to look at that? And what are the most important things to consider in it? What are you going to look at first to determine? Obviously, you talked about some of the most important factors, location, right? Some of the other things, but can you talk about that?
Sure. It is kind of a hierarchical position. You do kind of look at the bigger picture and everything and start to zoom in. You will start to wonder about zoning and regulatory issues. You need to understand if there's any historical issues. Many of our projects work with historical or tax credits on historical buildings, which also come with some restrictions. There's quite a few buildings here in Chicago that meet those historical requirements. So those things. And then we look at, you know, those technical issues of dimensionality, bay spacing, floor to floor heights, lease span depths. You know, we getting outdoor space, what, you know, balconies or those types of uses into a conventional office building, you know, is actually, there is a technical challenge to all that in terms of, you know, drainage and those types of issues. The residential buildings do require light and ventilation and or operable windows, if you will. So that means there's a new skinning. Most of the time, the office building will be of a size that's much larger than a residential use will consume. So a lot of the times you might see partial conversions of office buildings, like at 55 East Monroe, just because your office building might be 1 million square feet where you only need 200 or 300 to get apartments in. You know, apartments tend to average around 1,000 gross square feet per apartment. So it's hard to see a full office building converted.
And how are kind of the elevator stacks and the common areas, how is that all divided up when you're sharing an office building in a residential building?
Yeah, that's a good question. The office buildings typically might be 25, 30,000 square foot floor plates. So they do have enough dimension that you can separate entries, but fundamentally both user groups are walking back to the same core, but the elevator zones, we would segregate those out and separate them at the ground floor. And then there are also the issues with behind the scenes, you know, truck docks and incoming waste and those types of things, as well as the mechanical system, segregating those because there's typically different owners and operators and all of those things. So there is a whole legal and management side to the whole proposition too that needs to be worked through at the onset.
I don't believe you worked on it, but the Tribune Tower conversion, do you have any sense of what that was? Was that kind of a good infrastructure to work with? I know in the tower floors, right, that seems to make sense, right. But in the rest of the building, any sense of how that conversion went down?
I would imagine the generation of that building had significantly less depth or lease spans. So I imagine it worked out to be a pretty good conversion. You would be dealing with some relatively dated, you know, structural and floor systems and mechanical systems and all of that. So that'll be updated. I do know they're adding significant amounts of new construction to the project. So that should sort of help the economics of it all, as well as planning a sort of super tall tower on the east side of that site as part of the project too. So I'm sure it was a not easy project. And quite frankly, most of the reuse projects and buildings of that age are somewhat difficult. You're sort of discovering many things along the way.
Okay. And do you, I mean, being in Chicago and having a lot of experience, you know, internationally as well, I mean, do you have a lot of hope in the residential vibrancy of multifamily in Chicago? And is there a particular area that you would expect more of these conversions to happen? Just using Chicago as an example.
Well, as an example, and you know, you can sort of look at the West Loop today and the West Loop even 10 years ago. So it's quite radical and quite different. There is sort of a trend, if you will, that the office and the residential are much more linked today than they have been in the past. You know, it used to be the Loop was all office and then you go home, but there's much more of a mixed use flavor to the new working environment, and that sustains the lifestyle, the restaurants and the nightlife and the character of the neighborhood. And the West Loop is kind of a good example of that. We're seeing here in Chicago many more of those large-scale mixed-use projects, the 78 or Goose Island, and these types of projects that are fundamentally mixed-use and sustain this kind of diversity of the lifestyle. So I wouldn't be surprised to see the office density of the Loop decrease and fill in with some residential, as well as the close perimeter. Chicago's very fortunate with its transit system, and it makes it very convenient to move around if you're living close to it. So I sort of always have faith in the central loop here.
Right. I had got to see the Lincoln Yards project the other day, and it's really very ambitious, neat project that Sterling Bay is putting together.
Right.
They're trying to contemplate things that office users and residential renters and buyers will want, you know, 5-10 years from now. Right. Mm-hmm. And that seems a difficult task to me, but they're bringing in some futurists and some other kind of smart folks. But, you know, how do you build in that flexibility for the future? And what are some of the things that an owner should be contemplating when we're looking at how quickly things are changing from, you know, flying cars to drones to electric cars everywhere to maybe even very few cars and more other kind of modes of transportation we haven't thought about?
Right. Well, just to your very first point there, one of the things as architects we're talking a lot about these days is the 15-minute city, where everything you possibly need is a 15-minute walk from where you live. But as to flexibility, you're absolutely right. In many of the places I work, they actually define the buildings as 30-year buildings, 40-year buildings, or 50-year buildings in terms of anticipating their lifestyle, and it all relates to the ability to renovate them and zoning and many things.
So real quick question, sorry to interrupt your train of thought, but I am curious about that. I mean, when you get engaged in a project like that, do you go in with these different scenarios on how you would actually design, or how does that laid out?
We usually come in like in year 28 of a 30-year building project because they're ready to either tear it down and redevelop the property or something like that. And, you know, as a Chicago architect, we design things for eternity here. So we don't mess with that 30-year building stuff.
Got it. Okay.
So it is kind of interesting because if you look around, maybe except for the really trophy buildings in Chicago, office buildings, they might have 30 or 40-year lifespans before they really start to lose in technology and, you know, location, and everything changes about them. Their values decrease a lot as an office use, and then you have to start to contemplate, you know, what else can I do with this asset? And like in today's market, the lifestyle living downtown, it does really suggest that we'll see a lot of these 40, 50-year-old office buildings in the right locations start to really contemplate conversions because the real estate math justifies it all.
So what are the cost considerations when looking at these conversions, starting with, you know, the biggest cost? I'm assuming it's things like reskinning and stuff like that, but
compared to a new build, you have structure, you have cores, elevators, you have density and permissions, if you will, kind of in place, which sometimes, you know, are time consuming. So those, you're kind of starting off, I'll say, with maybe 30-35% of the cost of a new build already covered, maybe even more. But you have to work with the inherent inefficiencies that might come from the existing structure and what has to, maybe the base spacing isn't perfect like a new building might be, or depths. And so there is a inherent inefficiency that comes along with it too. So it is kind of a balance, but, you know, once again, if the right location and the right address and people want to live in that office building location, it should work financially, I would say.
Okay.
In terms of over a new build.
Okay. And do you expect more of these conversions in the future?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the city's kind of like a coral reef. It's a living organism, and one species starts to abate and another species starts to thrive. And I suspect our city will continue to do that. And, you know, there's also been fluctuations in and out of the city, but in the global picture, there's a grand trend towards urban migration that, you know, it was something like 20% 20 years ago. You know, people lived in the cities, and I believe it's well over 60% now. So there's a, in the grand picture of things, there's a move towards density.
And given your travels and seeing it from a global perspective, are there any other trends or anything you see happening in other international major cities that would translate here potentially a few years ahead?
Yes, there's a lot of things in terms of, I'm seeing much more sustainable infrastructure. It's no longer a fashionable thing. It's a really, you know, broadly accepted by the broader populations. And sort of as a corollary to that, I'll say, you know, what I'm actually find myself doing a lot is exporting some of the things we might do around here. You know, the concept of Millennium Park and taking to Tahrir Square in Cairo. But a lot of it is about infrastructure, investing in the infrastructure to support the economics of the city and allow it to grow. You know, the one thing I will say, because I have been practicing for more than 30 years, I can now visit those things I did 30 years ago, and it's really powerful. And the, you know, the investment in infrastructure and placemaking is a really powerful driver for a city that ultimately gets back to the economics of the place too.
Got it. Yeah, that's a great perspective on everything. So I think we covered everything here. And I would just, you know, tell the audience if they wanted to learn more about ratiodesign.com. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And actually, it's a great website. You have some really neat projects on there. So I would advise some people to look at it. And I know you guys are in Chicago at 30 West Monroe, one of my favorite buildings and an architectural landmark of sorts, right?
Right. We are on the fifth floor of Inland Steel. So when the building opened, SOM had located their sort of design department, you know, in this space right now. And so, you know, the real icons from SOM, you know, Walter Netsch and Bruce Graham and all of those people have all sort of sat on our floor here. So it's beyond building a nice building. There's a real history to this space that we sit in.
The ghosts of past architects walking through the halls, inspiring, right?
Ghost at night.
Yeah, right. All right. Well, I appreciate your time and safe travels to Cairo and other places you might be going.
All right. Thank you, Duo.
Thank you.